you've got an avenue of sight that we have with the better telescopes that will take us back.
And good afternoon. It is Wednesday, January the 20th, 2016, excuse me. Not used to that yet. 12:13 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're tuned into the Now program right here on WWGH Radio, and we have got a jam-packed two-hour program today you're not going to want to miss. Coming up at 1:10 p.m. today, we're going to be joined by legendary theater, movie, actor, Charles Grodin, also CBS commentator, former commentator on 60 Minutes 2. Charles Grodin, who will also be appearing in the Bernie Madoff miniseries on ABC on February 3rd and 4th. So you won't want to miss Charles Grodin live in hour number two today. Hour number one, though, we are going to have a gentleman on I love having on. He's an Ohio native. Couldn't ask for a better guy. He's the blueprint for how you do this job, broadcasting. He set the example for me and hundreds of other people. Legendary newsman from 2020 to the Today Show to even Jack Parr's announcer on the Tonight Show. You down, Jew? How are you?
I'm fine. Good talking with you.
You know what I just realized, you, and I didn't set it up this way. Charles Grodin was a dear friend of Jack Parr later in life, and you were Jack Parr's announcer, so there's a tie-in today.
Yeah, there is, I guess. That's true.
Well, I do want to let the listening audience know the reason I invited you on today was Stephen Hawking of Cambridge University came out with an article, many of you may have seen this, kind of fascinating, humans may not survive another 100 years is the tag in the article. You has interviewed Stephen Hawking. Before we get to the article itself, you, when did you go visit Professor Hawking, and what was that like?
That was probably 4 or 5 years ago that I was doing, and I was able to get that on to 2020 when I was doing that, you know, for I did that for 21 years, but when I did that, I could get that on to primetime commercial television, probably only because of his rather dramatic physical condition, which was awful. But having time to allow him to form the words he could on that sophisticated computer that he was given by Cambridge gave us 4 evenings in his home, and it was really worth a good time. When this article came out about him, I was wondering why he didn't sound off on this earlier. But I think he had a good reason to. He wanted to sit and see what was happening with what a viewing and listening public could digest, and it wouldn't just turn them off, you know, and that's a big challenge. But that was a wonderful time to spend with him, because, you know, all of his automatic system. He doesn't have any kind of a ventilator that he has to be on, because he breathes like we do when we sleep. We don't think about taking a breath. We just automatically do that, you know. And so all the automatic things work with him. But the things he can't do are things that involve his volition. You know, therefore, that's why he can't talk. And you are right. He's really a fascinating man, and he realized early on, I think, that the time is over when you've got the single individuals who are the geniuses and the inventors and everything. You know, the Edisons and people of that kind. It's now all teamwork, very advanced. You don't come up with something all by yourself. You become part of a team. You become something like either Lawrence Krauss's Institutes of Origins or Paul Davies' marvelous Beyond Center, both of them at ASU. And I'm really privileged to be able to call myself a friend of both of those guys.
You, for people who are not exactly aware of who Stephen Hawking is, who is he? How would you describe the man?
It's curious. His birthday happened to be, and this is a coincidence, happened to be the same date as the birthday of the giant thing, I got one of those blocks, I can't think of his name right now, but he kind of headed the scientific time of his time, and he was one of the last to be alone in doing that. And as I pointed out today, you can't do that all by yourself. You're a member of a team.
Albert Einstein, I believe it was.
It might have been. And Einstein came up with some, when he did his field equations, he didn't realize that he was inventing what was later to be supported by quantum mechanics and everything, and because he came up with a theory that actually was his field equations became the general relativity, which explained gravity and whatnot. And he thought it was a big blunder. He even said that, and invented a thing called a constant that he thought was necessary to keep the universe from expanding. Well, they don't keep the universe from expanding. It was expanding, and that was a bit much for him. For a long time, he couldn't really accept that.
For Stephen Hawking, when we read this article, why is it important that we listen to him? He's a genius, but how did he end up at Oxford? What is his backstory?
Well, as I said, it was really curious that he did wind up there, because he had that coincidental birthday with I'll think of his name in a minute that really supported the important findings of its time, and so it just was a coincidence, but he was smart enough to deserve the praise he got for what he had done. And he is dead on when he said, if we continue our habits as they are now, we won't last another 100 years. We'll do ourselves in. And it will be, if we do that and kill ourselves off, and I don't think we will, but if we did, Mother Nature would not get in a flurry about it. Mother Nature would yawn. She has seen so many species come and go that it would not be a big deal to her to see even the intellect that the humans have gone. Because in another 100 million years or so, life may appear that has intelligence like ours, and it doesn't matter. It's one of those things that just doesn't matter.
I do want to let the listening audience know I'm going to read a paragraph of this article so they kind of get what Stephen Hawking's saying. And the listening audience, take a look at the article if you get a chance. You can find it online. But it says, the psychiatrist says he believes humanity will face dangerous scenarios of our own making during the next century, including nuclear war, global warming, and genetically engineered viruses. And also this whole idea of spying on each other, he has something to say about that. You don't think we are going to go away in the next 100 years. What's going to stop it? How are we going to turn this around?
Well, I think we're going to turn it around because we have always been saved in spite of ourselves. And I think when it comes down to what we really need to do, something will help us to do that. And he couldn't be more right than to say that in another 100 years of doing what we're doing, we would do ourselves in. That would just be the end of humanity. Wouldn't be the end of the world, but it would be the end of our intelligence. And it would be a long time, maybe, if ever. Some scientists think that the intelligence is a fluke, will never be repeated. If we lost it, it would just never come back. I just can't subscribe to that, because I think the evolution of the universe shows that the appearance of intelligence came on faster than just ordinary chance would allow. So some force is putting that on for us. And that intrigues me more than anything.
How do you believe we got into this quandary of technology speeding up so fast and eliminating our ability to really communicate verbally.
Yeah, it did. It did a lot of things that were very challenging to us. And I think I can understand the scientists that think that it may be all up with us, that the limb that we're out on has already been sawed off. I just don't see that's true. I think that, I don't know why, but I think we've seen the end of the world too many times and found out that it didn't really amount to anything. And I don't think the world is going to end or the human intelligence is going to end. We will muster ourselves to do what we have to do to prevent that. I'm just convinced of that.
You know, I was thinking about this the other day. Almost all of the great advances in technology in the 20th century were brought about because of need. Medicines, surgeries, communication. The telephone was brought on because you can't go visit people who live, 500 miles from you every day.
Yeah.
But the new generation that started in the 21st century, did we really need to be able to type a message to somebody to communicate with them? This seems to be more... Is that something we had always wanted? That's what I can't figure out. It seems different.
You're talking about texting and that kind of thing?
Yeah, texting and emails and the whole bit.
Yeah, it is different. And as a matter of fact, it has done some damage, I think, to our ability just to converse. When you can look somebody in the eye and talk to them and make use of the idioms and the general atmosphere that you were brought up in, that's a form of communication that's much better than typing out however well you write. Typing a message to them or texting something. Communication has challenged me for a long time, and I didn't realize it, but that's why I have a school on human communication at ASU, is because I've been my entire life having any kind of a career, it was all based on that. I did it in radio, and then I did it in television, and now I do it in writing because I like writing, and that's a good way to do. But the challenge is if you lose your ability to communicate with people by looking them in the eye and adopting the idioms and whatnot that you're both familiar with. Then you're not really fully communicating, and I like to teach that you can communicate in a very multidimensional way if you have the conversation which we've had for many, many centuries.
If Hugh Downs was getting into broadcasting today, if he was 20 years old, do you think you would like the way that it's done with internet, with text messaging, with not so much being about a time slot, more about can you get it uploaded to the internet fast?
I probably wouldn't like it. I think it would be very challenging, and I'm not sure that I'm not even sure I could make it, but it's something that I've been intrigued with for quite a long time.
What do you think changed us? What do you think happened? Because there definitely is a difference. What do you think happened around 2004, 2005 that made this so popular, this texting, this email communication? What happened to us?
Well, that was the whole social communicating that went with Twitter and Facebook and that kind of thing. And I remember when somebody said to me, not too many years ago, said, Facebook is something you ought to do. And I was already retired. I retired officially in 1999. And they said, you ought to get with Facebook. And I said, well, it sounds like a nice idea, but what would it do for me? And they said, you could get a lot of new friends from it. And I said, I don't have time for the friends I've got. I don't want new friends. My daughter said, it would be good for your career. And I said, my career is a thing of the past. I'm now into much other things that keep me busier, and they're more intriguing to me than my career was.
Do you think it is a possibility, Hugh, that like Stephen Hawking kind of alludes to in this article, that because we all read it differently, but what I read into that article was, because of these drones, people are going to become a little more paranoid. We do talk a little less because of technology, and we do have nuclear weapons, which could essentially wipe out humankind. Do you think I know you don't think it's going to happen, but it could happen. And if it does, you know, that's a sad fact. 100 years is not that long a time. You know better than anybody.
Well, that is absolutely true. I'm in my 100th decade now. You know, when you think about, I mean, my 10th decade, because if you finish the 9th decade, then you're entering the 10th decade, and I've already got 9 decades plus behind me, and that's a challenge. And I realize if I was 20 years old and facing this, I probably would still be very interested in communication as I know it and love it. But I would feel pretty challenged, I think. And all of these things you mentioned, any one of them could rub us out. But as you know, I have strong feelings that is not going to happen, for reasons that are probably too boring and deep for me, or certainly not to impose on somebody else.
I'm just looking right now at the political scene, because there was a big story yesterday that in Great Britain they are voting, or certainly having a discussion in Parliament, to ban Donald Trump from their country.
Yeah, that's true.
We're becoming very angry.
Well, if he became, you know, I think there's a big danger now that if Trump has nothing to offer, and he is, just to state my own feelings about it, I think he's crumbling, and I don't think he will, but there's always a danger that he could be the flag bearer for one of our important nations, and we've got to. As it turns out, I'm not a Republican, but I will help the Republican Party so that it doesn't crumble away under a banner like Donald Trump seems to wave. He has nothing to make him a reasonable candidate. And this is one of the reasons I think England has always been very careful about certain things. If a demagogue looks like it's going to take over, and England has survived being, you know, it's all the isms that we're afraid of. England has them all. It's a monarchy. It's a democracy. It is socialistic. It's fascistic. It's all those things. And it lives with that, and it doesn't seem to bother it at all. And it shouldn't bother us, but it does. And we would suffer badly, I think, if the Republican Party got completely destroyed, which it could be destroyed by Donald Trump. He just doesn't have anything to offer except the danger that he represents. And I can understand England trying to make a decision as to whether he should even be allowed in.
Now, that being said, that you believe he has nothing to offer, then why does he lead the polls for 6 months?
Because he does, the one thing he does offer is a kind of a soft comfort for people who don't want to think too deeply. And I think that because of that, he gains that kind of support from people who don't. You bear in mind, half the people are below average by its own nature. And they all have the vote and should have the vote, but they're going to pull it down from what we, you and I may move. This sounds elitist, but we may move in circles that don't hover near that line where half the people are below it and half the people are above. And for that reason, we think everybody ought to think and understand, but everybody doesn't. And that's what our big danger is now, I think, because we could make some big mistakes. And I can understand what England is concerned about.
There was a poll that came out last week And I don't know if you saw it, but this is kind of interesting. I'll ask you this. There's a poll that I believe came out. It's in Wisconsin University. The poll has never been wrong in picking the president since 1975. Now, every year they do not run it for the president, but they run which party will win, who do they think will win, and this poll picked Barack Obama and Jimmy Carter before they were household names. Now, I'm going to toss this to you if you haven't read this article. Who do you think this poll says will be the Republican nominee come November?
Well, it's possible that they say that it could be Donald Trump.
Actually, they picked Jeb Bush.
Oh, they did pick Jeb Bush.
Jeb Bush.
That's good. I was afraid maybe they had strayed too far from from the line. But, no, in fact, Jeb Bush might have been president had it not been for the fact that his brother was older and went into a fit when the family wanted to have Jeb run for the presidency. And because George W. was older, he really threw a fit at that, and they finally yielded and made him the president instead. So I would imagine that Jeb Bush might have made a pretty good president too. I think he was very busy in campaigning to try to keep the name Bush down, because there was too much of a hint of a dynasty there, you know, with George H.W. and George W. And then if Jeb Bush was one wit said that he was trying to avoid the name of Bush. If he could get out of that, it would be all right.
It's certainly.
I like what was it, Jimmy? Not Jimmy Carter. Hillary's husband,
Bill Clinton,
who said that somebody said of him that he ought to write a book and call it Among the Bushes, which cracked me up.
He certainly has been there. That's for sure.
Yes.
Well, the interesting thing about this poll, stand corrected, it was Western Illinois University, and they've been right since 1975, but they have the election done right now, and they've never been wrong. They have the winner winning in a landslide, 404 electoral votes to 114. Do you know who they have picked as our next president? And they've never been wrong since 75.
I don't know.
Bernie Sanders.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Boy, that could be true, because there's stuff about Bernie Sanders that I think is really fascinating. And I always wondered why he didn't become an independent, but I know now he wants to keep he wants to be independent and not have us wind up with a one party situation, you know, which we don't want to do. But I think he'd make a very good president, actually.
Now, for all the people, all the commentators and all the magazines that say he's a socialist and that's impossible to become president, why would he make a good president?
Well, his common sense is so great. It's not just that he has the principles that I admire, but he has the ability to evaluate them as to what he can sell. You know, because somebody said once that the advertising was evil because it could induce people to do anything. And somebody else said, I think wisely, no, there's no amount of advertising money, trillions of dollars, that could induce people to eat copper. that's really a pretty firm belief, and I can see that. So we're not, as a public, we're not that dumb to accept things that are truly outrageously untrue. And I think when you get something like Trump in a presidential election, I just don't think. You know what I think of as the American voter? I think of the American voter as someone who stood in long lines in the rain and in the dark to elect as president a man who is half black, and then they did it because they knew that was right at the time to do. And that's who I think of as the American voter, and not somebody who would vote for Donald Trump.
Now, Bernie Sanders, self-proclaimed democratic socialist, why is socialism bad, or why do we fear that in the United States?
You know, we fear it, I think, because it's one of those words that got tainted with something bad. It's kind of like, what other things are tainted that way? Communism, for a while, was really, really gruesome. In what the idea that somebody might be a communist was so horrifying that they had laws that could severely punish people who could be proved to be communist, because that was just an awful thing. Well, what is communism? Communism is not what was governing the Soviet Union. None of that was communism at all, based on what Karl Marx had come up with as communism. That was a name given to a repressive, dictatorial setup for the government. But it was very evil, and I lived through that. Where one time I was reading a book, as a matter of fact, it's on the great books list, Karl Marx, and I had to ride the subway to work, and I had that book in, because it was Karl Marx on communism. What was the name? I can't think of the name of the book now, but he wrote this, and I put that in a brown paper wrapper because I thought if people on the train saw me reading something that was communist, it could have been the end of my career. That's all they needed at that time. It was a hint that somebody might be a communist, and that was just horrifying. And now I think to this generation, it's kind of funny and nonsensical, but it was a rough time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a news story of yesterday seemed to be that Sarah Palin has endorsed Donald Trump. Does that mean anything? Is she still a political player?
No, and I think it shows that Trump is so empty that he would permit that, that he just doesn't have anything going for him. And to me, that was just a sign that they were on the way out. And I think that's exactly what it means, because she's impossible.
You know, I consider you to be a very smart man, so maybe you can shed some light on this for me. Should Ted Cruz be allowed to run for president?
Should who?
Should Ted Cruz, who was born in Canada.
Yeah. Well, why would he? I think he would realize what opposition he would have to anybody in a different mood would not vote for him, because they would figure that he's not going to make it anyway, because he was not born in this country. And the only thing, you know, when that came up, there even was a question of whether Barry Goldwater could become president, because he was not born in the United States. He was born in the Arizona Territory, which didn't become a state till 1913. Well, that would have been a reach that they figured would not be a fair shake for him. But now it's so blatant that I just don't think anybody who really was born out of the United States could overcome an opposition that would point that out.
Another thing that was interesting, we talk about people and do they read enough, do they pay attention, are they educated? A poll came out yesterday that, now this is amazing to me, 10% of college graduates think Judge Judy is on the Supreme Court.
10%
college
and they
graduates.
Graduated from college. That's pretty funny. What I'd like to know what colleges they graduated from.
But you know, this is college graduates. Think if they took a poll of everybody. Yeah. How does that happen?
I don't know. It's kind of crazy when you think of it. But in a way, the fact that it's only 10% is heartening, because if it's not like the, you know, 10% of everybody that's underneath the poll that you know, is the even you know, above it you're okay mentally, and below it you're obviously less than average. 10% of that group, that's not too bad. I think we're doing pretty well with our educational situation in the country.
What do you think has happened to Hillary Clinton? It almost seems like deja vu from 2008. She's starting to go backwards in these polls to Bernie Sanders, and she's being attacked again on Benghazi and the emails.
Yeah.
Is there ever a chance she'll be elected?
There is a chance, because and one of the things I think that would do that is if they go all out and try to lambaste her with stuff that is truly ludicrous and kind of rude, I mean crude, really, and they're beginning to do that. And if they do that to her, there's going to be an opposition arise, a sense of unfairness on the part of the voter that will be to her advantage. And she will. She's got a chance of making it, no doubt. Because yes, she's got a lot of burden that she has to carry and maybe explain. But if they do some really bad things to her, that's going to help her get the presidency. That's my feeling on it.
Irregardless of who the Democratic nominee is, there is this talk that the Republican Party, with not appealing to women, not appealing to Latinos, really has no chance of winning the election. Is that true?
No, I don't think that there's no chance is too strong a thing to say. I don't think that's quite true.
When you vote for presidential elections, how important was it most of your life not to let people know who you voted for?
I'm sorry, an alarm went off here, and I just turned it off. Could you say that again? What is the question?
Yeah, when you were at the height of your journalism career, how important was it for you not to slide one way or the other, or let people know who you supported for president?
I don't know how to explain that, really. I felt there was no need. I didn't think it would have any effect. I thought it was too much ego identity protection. And for that reason, I didn't think it was important. I didn't care if somebody knew. But for me to do it just seemed to me a little bit too much ego, and that's the main reason I didn't.
Has somebody jumped out at you in this election? Long way to go, but is there somebody you really like?
In this election?
Yeah.
You know, I like several of them, actually, and I like Hillary. I don't think there's anything. And the funny thing is, among the Republicans, I like Jeb Bush also. So I think if he could prove he wasn't a Bush and establishing a dynasty, he'd have a good chance, and I think he'd make a good president. But that's among the Republicans, and I don't know how. You know, sometimes I hate to say this, but sometimes I meet a guy who's in the Republican Party who is really intelligent. He's got a handle on everything that's going on. And I have an urge inside me to ask him, why are you a Republican? That's a question I haven't had the nerve to really ask anybody, but you come up with that sometimes. Why would he bother being a Republican?
What are the flaws with the Republican Party?
What are the what?
What are the flaws, yeah. What is wrong with that party?
Well, first of all, it's a party that embraces principles that are good, but I think the party policies have never really promoted those in a way that would be human. You know, they go along with the it's like they go along with the words, but not with the deep meaning of the words. And I don't think they tend to. I don't think they tend to humanize what they are doing, and that bothers me a little bit, because that's a little bit too much what do you call it? Tea Party. It's too much like the Tea Party to me, and that's a thing that bothers me.
There's two things I want to cover here real quick, you. President Barack Obama gave his last State of the Union address last week. He's got less than a year left. Where is he going to go down in the list of presidents?
Oh, I think he'll go very well, really. Partly because for a long time, even the people who criticized him, and I was one of them, he so wanted to do things according to the book. He wanted to, if he had an idea, he did less personal things than he has lately done in order to make sure it went through Congress. But Congress was just a thing that wanted to oppose anything he did. And if you saw how that worked, I kept saying to him, it's not going to work. They don't want what you want to do. And if that may have bothered me after a while, but I felt like anything that he offered would be opposed by the Congress. And you know, that was the way it was for quite a while. And if he was hung with that, then I thought was being naive to think he could run it through Congress and do it the right way. But in the long run, I think he was doing it the right way. And this is a kind of a hard thing for me to imagine how much pay that took. And I think that's why I think he'll go down as a very good president.
On his watch, we saw Osama bin Laden captured and killed. We saw same-sex marriage legalized nationally. We saw health care for the first time with Obamacare. Has there been a president in your lifetime other than Franklin Roosevelt who more changed the country for the people?
You know, I don't know. Unless you want to really go back, I think Jefferson was a very good example. Because, you know, he had an awful lot of opposition in people like Adams and whatnot. If we think of those founding fathers as being all a glorious group that got it together and put the nation together the way it was. But they were quarreling like mad, and they really had a lot of bad opposition, worse than I think we've got now. Jefferson, I would have to give a very high vote. Who else? I don't know. You said besides
Roosevelt,
Teddy Roosevelt would have been one of them. Incidentally, it's a curious bit of trivia, but Teddy was a Roosevelt, and there's also Roosevelt, and FDR's wife, Eleanor, was both. She had blood in her from the Hoover, that is from the side that said Roosevelt and Roosevelt. So they were both. She represented both families, which is a bit unusual.
That is interesting. You know, when you see these polls now conducted of the greatest presidents of all time, there are some polls that put Ronald Reagan at number one.
Yeah, I suppose that's possible. Reagan did very well. He was really good at dealing with, he was people skilled, I would say, because what he did was I just thought he did a lot of good things, and he was very popular because he was a pleasant guy who wasn't trying to dictate. He wasn't much ego ridden either. And here's a man with all kinds of careers. When you think of it, he was an actor, and then he was a president, and he's been very, very good at whatever he did, and he was very, as I said, skilled in dealing with people. Generally.
You know, I just recently found this out, and I wanted to ask you, because I know you were at NBC Network very early on. Do you remember a man, I believe he was there in the radio days of NBC, the 40s, 50s, and I think even the 60s he was there, one of the higher-ups named Frank Mason.
Mason?
Yeah, Frank Mason.
Mason?
Yes.
Well, was he on a full network, or did he operate out of Chicago or New York at all?
He operated out of New York. I believe he was the vice president of the NBC Radio Network National in the 1940s.
Wow. Well, see, in 1944, I would have been in Chicago. If he was an executive of some kind, I probably didn't know him because I wasn't high up enough in the field to know the executives. But if he was on the air, I'd be very surprised that I would not recognize the name.
Well, it was interesting. I just recently found this out. He was a good friend of President Hoover. That's what brought that into my mind. But his brother and he started the first radio station here in the town we're in.
Is that right?
I didn't realize he was a big muckety muck at NBC.
What was his brother's name?
His brother's name was Bob Mason.
Bob Mason. No, it doesn't ring a bell. And I have lost some things that are coming back now, but if I ever did know, it's gone, maybe temporarily, but I don't recall the name.
One thing I want to touch on before our time gets away from us, Hugh, a big thing lately is definitely gun control, and you talk about those executive orders. That's one thing President Obama has done recently with those, is sign the executive orders for gun control. What is the big deal with this, and where are we going with it?
Well, everybody's been terrified of the NRA, which has so much in the way of funding that if you're in politics at all, they can ruin you if you come out. And the other thing is the whole concept of the Second Amendment being in danger is preposterous. There's nothing about the Second Amendment that says that there's nothing we could attack based on the idea that it would be an attack on the Second Amendment to impose any gun laws. Like, if you've got to have licenses and special licenses to drive a truck, why shouldn't you have to be licensed and vetted and very carefully looked at if you're going to want to buy a gun? And you can buy a gun. There's nothing that speaks out against that. The problem is, the tragedy is that, and I talked to a guy once who was a Walmart, checker out, you know, he was there with you. And a guy had come in who he felt was really mentally disturbed, who had got a military rifle and several boxes of ammunition. And this guy said, I can't refuse him. I have to be, by law, I have to allow him to buy that. And he bought it and went out and could have killed a whole bunch of people. Somebody like that did that, you know, with killing the first graders and the school, all the stuff you can name, where somebody who was not mentally fit to own that kind of thing was allowed to get it, thinking that the Second Amendment allowed them to do that. Second Amendment only says that a community has the right to establish a militia. That's what the Second Amendment is. Not that an individual has a right to buy a military weapon. And they don't have that right. And yet everybody was afraid to enforce that until Obama finally came up with that. Because Obama always thought of those first graders that got killed by somebody who had a gun who shouldn't have been, if he was properly vetted, they would never have allowed him to get a gun. So it's just a misunderstanding of what it is. But I think it's over now. I think that's crumbling.
Why do we need assault weapons? For people who say these are something we need, you can't take them away, it's our Second Amendment right, well, what is the use for them?
What is the what?
The use. Why does a citizen need an assault weapon?
No citizen needs an assault weapon. Their community are permitted or even encouraged to establish a militia to protect the community against their government. And that's really what that was out for, in case the wrong policy makers got into power. And so the Second Amendment is protected that way, and it protects the community. But it doesn't protect a right to buy a gun when you are not mentally fit to own a gun. And that's something that just is widely misunderstood, I think. And the politicians were afraid to tackle it because they have too much power against them that way. But not being in politics, it sure doesn't bother me to attack them, because I think it's total misunderstanding and a lot of harm coming from the way it is now.
Hugh, before I let you go with only 3 minutes left, in 25 days you have a big birthday coming up on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
My goodness, I can't even believe. 95, that's amazing.
Yeah, well, it is to me too, I guess. And you know something I can honestly say? Every decade of my life has been better than the preceding decade. Now, there are some losses when you get older. You know, I can't do something, you know, I can't establish a baseball career, say, that I, if you try that after you're 30, you're mad. And a lot of those things I can't do don't bother me, because what I can do and how I see things is so much better than it was the decade before, that it's worth it. And I think the worst decade of all is the first of anybody. They are being born is pure hell. You come out of a place where you've been warm and contented, and an umbilical cord supplies all your oxygen and nutrition, and you're comfortable, and suddenly you come out into a world that is harsh. You've got lungs full of phlegm and everything. You can't breathe right. That's the worst decade of all, is the first 10 years and the first year and the first day is awful when you're born. And I once thought, why would I, when there are Christians that are called born-again Christians, I said, why would anybody want to be born again? Being born in the first place is the worst thing that ever happened to them. And I feel that way, and every decade has been better than the one before, in spite of some losses as I got older. So that's given me a very happy and very lucky life.
Well, want to get two quick questions in, because I recently watched your interview. I believe you were 79 when you left ABC back in 99. And you did an interview with Barbara Walters on your last 2020. And two things you said were, you said you were worried about old age because there might be a point where you might not be able to get up on the horse anymore. And also, you had had some knee replacements, and those were good to last for about 15 years. Now, you've exceeded both of those, so are you still getting on the horse, and how's the knees?
Yeah, no, I don't mind. The only reason I don't get on a horse is because I've gotten thrown off of horses a lot, and I think if I got thrown off of a horse now, it would do damage that it couldn't do in an earlier year. So I don't bother getting on horses. I just don't think it's worth the risk. And as far as my knees go, I've never abused them. I'm not a runner. And those things have been x-rayed and everything, they're just perfect. That's the best part of me. My knees are about 25 years old, I think. They make me feel like I'm 25 years old in the knee department. And you know the beauty of that is I watched that whole operation. Had an epidural that made everything from the belt down completely dead to any pain or anything like that. So I got to watch the entire operation, and it was fascinating. There's a lot of hammering and sawing going on.
Like I always say, one of the greatest thrills of being able to do a talk show on radio is to have the people on who you admire so much, and there is never any greater thrill than when Hugh Downs joins this program. I hope you continue to do it. I hope you have the best 95th birthday, and I hope we talk again next time something in the world starts going batty.
I will be looking forward to that. Thanks a lot, Scott. I enjoy doing that.
Thank you, Hugh.
Righto.
Bye-bye.
So long.
And Charles Grodin coming up in about 15 minutes. Don't you dare go anywhere.
www.wwgh1071